I'm thrilled to say that this series of Beyond the Bathroom is sponsored by Skin & Me, the subscription skincare service tailored to provide what your skin needs. Make sure to keep listening for a discount code you won't want to miss. That's for later in the episode. Now on with the show. Hi, I'm Sally Hughes and this is Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I chat to my guests about their relationships with their own appearance. In Beyond the Bathroom, I attempt to get under the skin of my guests' beauty routines and rituals and hope to find out exactly what they see when they look in the mirror. How has their past affected the way they see themselves now? When did they look and feel their best? And how has their relationship with face and body shifted as life has ebbed and flowed? Today's guest is Alex Light. Alex is a fashion and beauty writer whose honesty about and reaction to her own complex body issues led to her transformation into a leading body positivity influencer and commentator on diet culture. To her audience of 500,000 or more followers, she calls out body-related misogyny and the constant drip-drip of judgment, expectation, and double standards landing daily on women of all ages and sizes. But when she's not fighting on behalf of them, is she able to extend the same kindness to the reflection in her own bathroom mirror? And what must-haves does she keep in the cabinet behind it? Before we start today's episode, I just wanted to give you a heads up and a trigger warning for anyone who has suffered from any mental health issues around diet culture, body image, and disordered eating. These themes will be explored in the episode, so please proceed with caution. Hello, Alex Light. You were one of the first people we booked and the last person we've recorded because there was a heat wave. Can you remember?
Yes.
We had to cancel, didn't we? Because literally trains were cancelled because it was too hot, which
it
is
was so hot.
Where we are as a country, I would say.
Like 35 degrees, wasn't it? Plus, yeah. Well, I'm happy to be here.
I'm so glad you finally made
Better
it.
Better late than never.
Thanks for being here. So much to talk to you about. Such a kind of unique insight I think you'll have. But can we just go back, because context is so important in how people feel about themselves, especially in terms of how they grew up. I was reading up on you and watching various things you'd done and heard that you went on your first diet at 11.
Yes.
Why and what was influencing you at that time?
So I went on my first diet at 11, but I was acutely aware of my body image long before that. And I think there's a study, and I don't think I'm butchering this, but I think there's a study that says around the age of six, girls become aware of their bodies. Not their bodies in terms of their functions and how they work, but more how they look, you know, the aesthetics of the body.
Not what it can do, what it's capable of, the health it's in, how it looks in the mirror and to
others. Exactly. That applied to me fully. I grew up in a really diet culture heavy environment where the people around me believed that thinness was beauty, was desirability, and that it equaled success and lovability, and that fatness equaled all those things that our society depicts fatness as, like laziness, greediness, sometimes even, which is even more sinister, evilness, you know. For example, with the, like, you know, the Disney villains tend to be in bigger bodies, whereas the princesses are always in thin bodies. And I really absorbed these messages because that's what kids do, right? They only know what they know, and they only know what they're around, and they absorb those messages. So I believed that I had to be thin. However, my body wasn't thin. My shape, my size, I'm just not meant to be a thin person. I'm a bigger build. I'm not fat, and I was never fat, but I was always, I say chubby. I was like a chubby kid, and I was acutely aware of that and the fact that I wasn't thin. It became then this thing that felt very opposing, as like one side of me knew that I needed to be thin, but the other side of me wasn't thin. And then that's where everything started, and that's where the clash began. And I realized that through diets and through manipulating what I ate, I could manipulate how my body looked. And that was the starting point for a very long and horrible and dark journey that lasted for decades then.
So tell me about that, because I'm the mother of teenagers. I'm surrounded by lots of parents of teenagers. Very many of them are going through some stuff. in this area, whether they have boys or girls, in fact.
Right.
So tell me what the kind of trajectory looked like, I suppose. So you're very aware from what, 6, 7? Then you're 11 and you think, oh, I could do something about this and then I would be what everyone wants me to be. How do we get from there to being quite unwell? What does that look like?
So I started on, I would collate diets from various places. And it was extremely easy to do because the accessibility to diets was just...
They were everywhere in every magazine.
Right? Yeah. This is the 90s. So they were all over magazines. I would rip different ones out of magazines on TV. There'd be something else. My mum, my aunties would be doing something. I would hear, my peers at school, what their mums were doing. And so I would bank all these diet ideas and just go through them one by one, thinking each time that this one was going to work or that one was going to work. And I did. And I honestly mean it when I say I did every diet under the sun. up until probably 5, 6 years ago, I think I've tried every single diet that was out there.
Wow.
With varying results, usually some initial success, because that's what diets tend to do, which is why people believe that diets work, because they do initially.
Sure.
But it's never sustainable, and it was never sustained for me, and I couldn't sustain it. And so I did diet after diet after diet, and actually what happened is I dieted myself up in weight, because
your metabolism was screwy.
Your metabolism, and also you... When you deprive your body of something that is a basic biological need, food, right? We need it. It then has a biological response, which is very normal, and it's great that our bodies do this. But that response is to then eat more than perhaps it needs, right? And that's why a lot of chronic dieters end up weighing more than people who have never dieted in the first place.
Yeah.
And that's what happened to me. I went up and up and up and up in weight because of all this dieting, this constant dieting.
So losing loads of weight, then putting a bit back on and going, oh, that doesn't work anymore, and going on to the next diet and having similar results over and over and over.
Right.
Kind of creeping slowly. Yeah. I mean, that's just like the classic dieter's pattern.
Classic.
Yeah.
Yeah, of that initial weight loss. Everyone tells you how amazing you look. You're getting all this positive feedback, and that makes you desperate to maintain this body size, and then you realize that you're struggling. You've got this biological urge to eat, which is extremely strong and overrides everything in the moment.
Yeah.
But then contrasting side of you that's like, no, don't eat. No, don't, because you don't want to put this weight back on. And it's this horrible, horrible vicious cycle that doesn't seem to have an end. And the only hope, when you're in it, it feels like the only hope is another diet. So that's what I continue to do, another diet, another diet, another diet. After university, I went to live in Madrid, and I managed to get a job at Hello Magazine as a fashion writer. I'd done lots of interning prior to that, and it's something I always wanted to do, and it was great. And I then transferred to London, and I feel then that I really became more involved in the fashion scene. And as you know, the fashion industry is, fatness is absolutely vilified, and thinness is glorified to the extent that eating disorders are really glorified. For example, it was it was cool to say, oh, I don't eat all day, I only have one meal a day, we just survive on coffee, that's what we do. And I think that, I don't know at what point it happened, what specific point, whether it was like a moment that there was a specific moment, but I felt like the being in the fashion industry and these further messages around thinness and fatness really compounded everything. And it seemed to unlock then this new mental state that was much darker, whereby I kind of unlocked a state where I, and like huge trigger warning, and I'm sure you'll put a trigger warning at the top of the episode as well, whereby I found myself suddenly able to not eat. And I survived then for a long time on it's awful to say, it's so triggering as well, sorry, but on boiled sweets. I would just suck boiled sweets days and days on end. And I would do juice dieting. Juice dieting was really big at the time. Everyone was on juice diets in the office. But for me, it was on a different level. And it was more... It felt more dark for me. Everyone would be laughing about their juice diet. I guess I was on the surface, but it was So you have, on a juice diet, you have 5 juices a day. And I started at that. And then I thought, well, I can just try 4 juices a day. Yeah, and maybe I'll lose weight a bit quicker.
Right.
Went down to 3, went down to 2, went down to 1, and then boiled sweets. I survived off that. I don't have any more insight onto how it descended into a full-blown eating disorder, because that time as well feels like an absolute blur.
So it sounds like the form your disordered eating took was deprivation. Would you have swings into binging because your body's like, for God's sake, give me some calories? Or
not really. Not at that point. I was in the throes of anorexia, and that really had its grip on me. And I was terrified of eating food and scared that if I did eat food, it would lead to a binge, because I was the animal part of me was just desperate for food, and I was scared it was going to take over.
What's interesting, I mean, you will have given this a great deal of thought, I'm sure. Although you were working on Hello, and I think it's fair to say Hello magazine is by nowhere near the worst offender in that kind of diet culture. It's a different kind of magazine.
Totally.
It's not a magazine that's wall-to-wall dieting or circle of shame around people's cellulite. It's not that brand. However, you entered an industry. There's no getting away from it. You entered an industry that is so critical or fixated at best on people's bodies. I wonder if you've considered whether you kind of steered into the skid a bit there, that there was something about that industry that you felt you had to be a part of.
Do you know what? I've actually never considered that, but that's potentially a really good point. It's something that I've not considered, but...
Do you feel conflicted about your work in the industry, or do you feel, no, I was all right, actually?
Well, as you say, I was lucky that I was at a magazine that wasn't part of that. We were very... We were always positive, and it's a magazine known for its lack of negativity.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of articles I did about weight loss and this celebrity's weight loss and how amazing does she look, where she also looked great before, you know? So I totally fed into that. So I guess there is a part of me that's had to reconcile what I do now with what I did back then. And I think I sort of fueled it both for me and all the people reading, and also in my private life as well. In my personal life, I was a huge proponent of diets, like constantly talking about diets, constantly talking about what I was eating, tweeting about it, like tweeting some awful things about wanting to, you know, it's just, they horrify me now, but you only know what you know, right? And
yeah.
I didn't know any different. But that is a really good point that you mentioned, actually, that potentially my world was so preoccupied with appearance and weight, and you know, I would hungrily, you know, like eat up, like, no pun intended, but like consume articles about celebrity, you know, prior to any journalism that I did, consume articles about celebrities' weight and dieting. And there used to be this website that like listed all celebrities' weight. I have no idea.
I mean, how would they know
this? Accurate or not? Yep, exactly. Definitely not accurate. But I would pore over this website, and you know, I was obsessed, like totally obsessed. So it's actually probably you were probably not far off the mark there. Yeah.
What brought change then from being very much part of the machinery, although on a fairly kind of benign, innocuous kind of brand, but within a fairly toxic industry? What was your trigger to go, I need to get myself better, I need to do something different?
This is a hard one, because I feel as well that a lot of the narrative around recovery and eating disorder recovery, and actually recovery from anything, any kind of illness or addiction, is always the way it's portrayed, and the way it feels and it felt to me like it's depicted in the media is always very much like there was this aha moment,
sure,
got help, got better, ta-da, like live a carefree existence now. And that wasn't the case for me at all. It was really complicated and quite convoluted. And it was my mum initially that marched me to the doctors. I was lucky enough to have private medical insurance with my job, because I know that help with eating disorders is really difficult. And I was diagnosed with anorexia, and then I started with a therapist, and it was such a slow process. She started to open up my eyes to diet culture, and perhaps the fact that I felt like I needed to be thin wasn't innate in me, that it was conditioning, and that actually it's learned, and that I was okay as I was. But that didn't feel real to me for a very long time. It didn't feel real to me emotionally. I started to intellectually. It started to make sense and I was putting the pieces together, but it wasn't working. It wasn't there yet on an emotional lower sort of level. And then my eating disorder then morphed into bulimia, which continued for a fair few years. And then ultimately binge eating disorder. And all the time, all throughout this period, I was doing therapy. And I think what was happening was, while I felt like I was making no progress and while I felt like my eating disorders were just becoming another eating disorder, what was actually happening is that I was putting things into place that just hadn't yet amounted to perceptible progress. But I was doing things that were changing my mindset and giving me more tools to cope. And I know that this isn't a sexy answer. Like, I'd love to give like a lovely answer all wrapped in a bow. Like, this is my moment. This was like what?
No, yeah, but it's... No, I'm more interested in what actually happened, because I agree with you. There's an idea with all addiction, with all kind of disordered behaviour, that you hit a rock bottom and, you know, it's really, really terrible. And then you decide to change your life and all of that. But I think what I've learned over many, many, many years in journalism of talking to women, so many women with eating disorders, because we are women, you trip across them all the time, of you go, that I've learned that very often it's a work in progress for the rest of your life. It's a, you know, it's a question of constantly right. checking yourself, checking your behaviour, monitoring your feelings and the directions you're kind of headed in. Is that where you are now? And is your work healing to you in that way? Is it therapeutic, I suppose, not healing?
My work has been massively therapeutic, and I think initially as well, that was half of it. Me wanting to do this work and explore this world of diet culture, half of it was wanting to truly and fully and for once and for all get out of this mindset that I need to be thin, because it's still dominating my life. I do think, I think to an extent, that people that suffer from anything like this will always live to it to an extent. And I like the analogy of, it's like you break a bone in your knee, okay? And the bone will set and heal, but there will always be a little sore spot, right? And you build your cartilage around it, you know, and you strengthen your knee, and so there's more padding, but there will always be a sore spot. And I think that I notice that things can trigger me, and, you know, now and instantly I'll go back to that person. It just hits, there's just a very emotional, like visceral response, and I'll go back to that eating disorder voice of, well, see, I knew it. I told you I'm not good enough. I knew this. I was trying to tell you, you need to be thin, there is something wrong with you, you don't, you know. But I think what's good now is that I'm so well versed. I'm so good at pulling myself back out of that now. Whereas before, I would spiral and it would take me into days of self-loathing and potentially a lapse in my eating disorder. I'm quick at pulling myself back out of that and employing my rational brain to say, like, hey, it's like, and also calling on some compassion as well, which I think is what is lacking, not just in this conversation around body and body image, but like for women in every area of their lives, and probably men as well. But I do tend to focus on women because that's my experience. It's actually okay that I have this response, and it's okay for me to be triggered, and it's okay to know that this will be with me forever. And that in itself is a really powerful and liberating thing, rather than fighting it and thinking, I should be over this by now. After all the work I've done, I've written a book on this. I should know by now. I should know better. But it's actually really incredibly sort of freeing to say, it's okay that you have that. You can lean into it for a second, but you can also come out of it, and then you can just leave that behind you.
I feel like things, hopefully, are shifting, not within wider culture, but within women's lives. I hope the conversation is shifting away from body positivity more towards an acceptance, right? Because I think right. pressure to love your body is kind of ridiculous too, right? Because we live in the world we live yeah. in. And so I was wondering what your thoughts were about that. I mean, to me, it seems that the healthy thing is not to say I'm perfect, whatever shape I am, it's that I accept what I am.
Right, and lean into more towards body neutrality, which yeah. I think in an ideal world, that's where we'd be, is body neutrality. We have full neutrality about how we look, and where how we look doesn't impact how we live our lives. And I think that's the ideal world. I do think, like, in order for change to happen like that, the pendulum does have to swing
absolutely
the other way. And body positivity has been so, it's been amazing for people, especially people in the minorities who have never seen themselves represented, especially in the media. And I think that's been absolutely vital. And I think it's still important that that continues to happen. But I agree with you that it doesn't, I don't think it helps to say love your body. I don't think that's helpful because I think it sets another standard that is really difficult for us to live up to, because you can do self-love work, self-acceptance work until you are, you can do it all day, all night for the rest of your life, but we don't live in vacuums. We live in a world that still screams at us that we're not good enough as we are. We need to change this, to change that, to look better in this way, that way, and get rid of this, get rid of that, and that still glorifies thinness. Values that we are learning, they, when we step outside, they're not represented back at us, right? We have to account for that. There has to be space for conversation around that as well, which I do think is lacking in social media. For example, there doesn't seem to be a space for people to talk about losing weight now, because that seems to get shut down in the name of body positivity.
Yeah.
And it's true that a lot of weight loss is because of standards, beauty standards, and because we are attempting to adhere to a beauty standard that is completely arbitrary. However, it doesn't do any good to just say to people, no, don't lose weight, you're fine as you are.
You're letting everyone down if you're losing weight.
Yeah, you're letting people down by wanting to lose weight.
Yeah.
And actually, there is much more of a process to be had than that, of we need to allow space for that and allow people to express how they feel about that and encourage people to explore the reasons why, explore the reasons behind it, but allow them at the end of the day to do whatever they want, because body autonomy is like the most important thing, right? And I have gone on a journey with this myself as well, with what I've been putting out on social media. Like, I feel initially I showed a lot of my body and showed a lot of my what society has historically deemed as flaws, like stretch marks and cellulite and fat rolls, and that to me initially felt important. And to see that on social media,
sure,
initially that was like really helpful to me. But I realized that that felt like treating a symptom to me. And I'm not speaking for everyone, but for me, that felt like treating a symptom. But I needed to get to the root of it and find out, okay, but why were they deemed flaws in the first place? Why do I feel like I want to be thin?
I find that perspective really interesting and so rare. I never hear it. So I've had issues with that kind of stuff in the past, just consuming it. Look, there is no equivalence here. I'm absolutely not going to put my hand up and say, you know, that I'm not privileged in that way. I've always been the same dress size. I don't have weight issues, body image issues. My mother wasn't a dieter. I just didn't have that stuff around me. And I know that's hugely privileged, and I have an able body and all of that.
Yeah.
So I'm very much a bystander in all of this. But I think as a woman, what I've always found a bit tricky about the body positivity movement, I was on the radio once and I was asked to talk about a calendar that a load of celebrities had done. And I was asked to comment on it. And I remember just saying, I just don't understand why female body positivity always has to mean taking your clothes off. Like, I don't understand why for so long, and I think it's shifting because of people like you having these conversations, I felt like for ages for a woman to show she was confident and happy in her body, she had to just take loads of clothes off and go, da-da, here's my flesh. And look, there is a place for it. And I can see how it's helpful and therapeutic and necessary after being kind of told to hide away for so long. I get that it's part of the process, but I think there has to be something else for lots of women that isn't just like, look at my bum, I'm proud of my big bum, or I'm proud of my cellulite, or whatever it is. And I wonder if you think it is heading in a different direction slowly.
I think so, because like what you're saying, and I've spoken to so many women who have said, I see all these women on social media who are showing their bodies, and their bodies don't fit society's standard of beauty.
Yeah, I get the importance of that.
I think they look beautiful, but I can't apply that to myself. Why not? And so there is the problem.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I've started to see that shift yet. Maybe I'm possibly too involved in it that I don't have any perspective. I can't really zoom out. But that's definitely what I am trying to do. I am attempting to do is, and take away, as you say, the focus on bodies. I think other things need tackling, like the media and how the media talks about women's bodies. Like, that's a huge thing, and a huge thing that is making up a lot of what we consume, what people consume. And it's great on social media, because social media, for all its pitfalls, like, we're able to create and steer our own narrative, which is amazing. Like, we're able to say now that, no, we don't need to be thin, and we can look however we want, but the media is not quite there yet. So I think things like that need tackling as well.
So I'm fascinated by this. As we've discussed, pivot is not the way to describe it, because it was such a process for you, a more nuanced and gradual process. But I'm interested in the fact that for people like you who want to have this conversation, the place where you have autonomy, control, creative control and all of that is social media. And social media is also in many ways the most toxic proponent of the culture that you're talking about. So I suppose I wanted to talk about your relationship with social media, and how hard is it to do the work you do in arguably the most problematic space in some ways?
Yeah, I find social media to just be confusing is probably the word.
Yeah, right. Because it's everything all at the same time, right?
Right. On one hand, it's been a place where it's allowed beauty standards and unattainable beauty standards to thrive. Because it's not just where you're seeing a billboard or you're seeing someone in a magazine who you know is a model, who you know has had hair and makeup and God and retouching. Now it's you're seeing these perfect images of people that you know, people from real life, and then that starts to really deepen the comparison in a very negative way. And I think social media has done a lot for inducing feelings of inadequacy in lots of generations now. But at the same time, that's the thing. At the same time, it's been amazing for giving a voice to, and especially minorities as well, who don't have a voice outside of social media. That's been amazing. So
people who would never be in magazines and newspapers.
Exactly.
And on the telly.
They've been able to represent themselves, which has then led to representation in the media. So, like I said, for creating our own narrative and for the masses to be able to have a voice, I think it's been amazing. But there are two sides of it. It feels very dichotomous, and I don't know how to bridge that gap as well, because the younger generation seem to be very involved with the more toxic and negative side of it, where filtering is now more common than it is. It's like, if you don't filter, if you don't manipulate an image, mm-hmm. it looks strange. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's scary. You know, I spoke to a 15-year-old who said, I would like to not filter my images, but if everyone else is, I can't not.
It's hard to jump out of the race. Yeah.
Yeah. And she said, when I see an image like yours or you know, other people where they haven't touched it, where there isn't a filter on it, it looks weird to me now. And that is really scary, because the lines between, you know, it's blurring the lines of reality. So that's really scary. So I feel like with the work I do, it's just a constant, it feels like, what's that game where you're like, hitting
whack-a-mole.
Yeah, that, where just something else pops up, and I'm in a bubble as well. You know, I am a huge advocate of curating your feed, and people say it all the time, like, curate your feed. It seems to be like a very general piece of advice now, but it's so powerful, because what we are consuming all day long now, like, I can't remember the statistics, but we're constantly on our phones and we're consuming. And if you can manipulate what you consume to be positive and to be things that uplift you and inspire you and challenge you and help question your beliefs, then it's amazing. And we actually, the power is in our hands. That's the thing, that we can manipulate the algorithm. It's wanting us to manipulate it. It actually wants to show us what we want to see. But I feel like there's a lack of education around that for younger people who don't necessarily know that, or who are all going one way and are only going down this path and don't necessarily realise that there's another path.
Well, but in the centre of all this is a real person who has... So you're out there trying to change the conversation and trying to move the needle, but you're still a person at the centre of it, and you're on social media, which can be a hostile place. Right?
Yeah.
So how do you, Alex, feel about trolling? How do you get trolled? I was kind of doing a deep dive, but you know, and it seems sometimes you're not fat enough to talk about body image. Yeah. You know, you need to be much bigger, or you have no skin in the game, right? Yeah. Or so you're too thin, or you're too big, or whatever it is. So what? How do you inside react when somebody is describing back at you how your appearance falls short for them on social media?
Do you know what? Interestingly, initially when I started doing this, and like I said, I was showing my body a lot at first, so I was getting lots of body related comments, and initially, like, my account over the pandemic went viral, and so there were a lot of eyes on me all at once.
Yeah,
I was getting a lot of messages,
and that's potentially quite triggering to somebody who's had mental health issues around their body image. That's a lot.
I went into a lot of different spirals.
Sure.
I remember the worst was someone telling me that, and it's always worse when it's wrapped up in what appears to be a nice message, right? You know, it feels backhanded. You know, it would be, I remember this message. It was kind of just when my account first started to go viral, and she said, like, I get what you're saying, but you looked so much better when you were anorexic.
Wow.
Really hurt. That's
so horrible.
That really hurt. Like, as I was saying before, like, that trigger of that.
I liked you when you were really ill and unhappy.
Exactly. Yeah, when you were in pain.
Yeah, yeah, she is.
But that voice came straight rushing back in saying, well, there you go. I told you. You know, you've been trying to shut me out, but I told you. You're not good enough as you are now. And it was really horrible. But I feel like I've done in the past few years so much work on my appearance, and I've become so comfortable in my body. I'm not saying I love it and I'm obsessed with my body and I like love it all the time, but I'm comfortable in my body, and appearance related comments don't really seem to cut that deep anymore, which is really good. But other stuff does, and I'm not gonna lie and say I don't find that hard, because I find it really hard. I find any kind of trolling, it really hurts.
Yeah, it's horrible.
It's painful.
It's horrible. I feel the same as you. I don't care what people really say about my appearance. I mean, I don't care. I'm not somebody who would walk around on social media in a bikini, but nor do I have any complex. I just, like, I don't care if you think I'm ugly or fat or whatever it is. It's the other stuff, isn't it? It's the deeply personal stuff about family,
right,
and so on.
Right. And your work, you know, anything you value. Right?
Yeah.
It's things
you
value when that is attacked. And I challenge anyone, honestly, to read things about themselves. Nobody could. No, it's painful. It's really hard. But I'm in the process of trying to be at peace with learning that what other people think about me just doesn't matter. I'm saying that as someone who's absolutely not there.
I mean, we don't live in a vacuum. And, you know, you're essentially playing a game that you didn't volunteer for, the rules of which you didn't design or invent, right? So you're just kind of on the field trying to play this game you didn't ask for. And so it's impossible to be wholly immune, but also good to remind yourself that it's precisely none of your business what somebody's thinking about.
Yeah. And this is not obligatory for anyone who, you know, has nasty comments leveled at them. But for me, I find it helpful to call on compassion for that person, because it's clearly a projection of their own issues and their own insecurities, and
always
it's causing them an initial rush of it's initially sort of alleviating the pain that they're feeling, very temporarily alleviating the pain that they're feeling,
it's
to try and inflict it on someone else.
As a leading psychologist told me about trolling when we were working on a project together, she said, the reality, and do with it what you will, but the reality is when you read those comments, is one thing is absolutely certain, is they're never happier than you. And I think, you know, that's essentially it, but it's still, you're still standing in front of it, right?
Yeah. It's making you believe that fully and making it feel real, I guess, is hard.
I suppose I hope coming back to you, and I'm interested in your relationship with it still, is fashion and beauty. So this was something you loved. This was something you wanted to work in.
Yeah.
That interested you, that excited you. It's obviously a very creative area. Do you still love beauty? And which parts of your love of beauty are harder to square with yourself than others?
Beauty is one of the biggest loves of my life. I'm obsessed with beauty, and I hope I always will be. Because I started out as a fashion writer and then became a fashion and beauty editor, and then latterly at Hello was just beauty editor, because I felt like that was where I just love beauty. I really love beauty. Yes, there are some parts of it that I find difficult to reconcile with the work that I do, mostly that a lot of beauty relies on women having insecurities, feeling inadequate and feeling that they need something to, you know, alleviate that. And obviously it's a great, it does play into the patriarchy, but I just absolutely love it. And I always think, like, I would never want to be in a world without beauty, without makeup particularly, but I would love to be in a world where the pressure to wear makeup didn't exist.
I see. For me, so I feel the same as you. I absolutely love beauty, but for me, the problem starts when people conflate beauty with the beauty industry, which are two completely separate entities that feed off each other, of course, but they're not the same thing. You know, I sort of think of it the way I feel about food. Like, I hate intensive farming. I hate battery hen conditions. I hate food waste. I hate the pollution that the food industry causes. It doesn't mean I should hate cooking. And so they feel like two quite separate things for me. So I have a million issues with the beauty industry. I talk about all the time within it. But the creativity and the practice of beauty, for me, feels pure and warm and lovely and much more female-centred than we maybe think of the guys in the suits who need to sell the lipstick.
Yeah.
And so it sounds to me like the rituals of beauty still do something nice to you.
Totally.
So what does that look like at home?
I love experimenting with makeup. Like, nothing gets me quite excited like a new product that someone has recommended to me.
Yeah.
I love exploring new products. I love watching makeup videos. I at night when I get into bed and I just want to switch off from my world, you know, on Instagram, I just go on TikTok and type in makeup videos and just watch them. And that's my form of escapism. It's therapeutic to me. I like screenshot different beauty products that I'm like, God, I need to try this, or different techniques. I just love it. I love it. And I think I always will. And I even like how it changes my appearance. And I feel like I'm now at peace with saying that. And, you know, I think a lot of people want me to be this, you know, like, perfect human, that if I strive to accept my body, then I should strive to accept my face exactly how it is, without makeup, and my hair without dyeing it, and my skin without using skincare. And that's just not me, and that's not where I'm at. And I love it. I love it all.
Everything's artifice. I mean, you know, everything. Yeah. You can't opt out of that stuff that's been going on for thousands.
Right. And nor do I want to. And that's the crucial thing. Like, I don't want to. I enjoy those things. Like, they're a big part of my life.
Lots of my readers have said to me over the years, lipstick and perfume always fits.
Yeah.
And that's the joy of it, that everybody can smell like $1 million, right? Yeah. Everybody can put on a perfume, whether they are older, younger, bigger, smaller, more able, less able. Everyone can just smell amazing.
Yeah. I love that. Lipstick and perfume always fits.
Yeah.
I love that.
But there is something quite egalitarian about that. You know, there's something quite democratic about that. And I wondered if beauty's been that for you, where whatever's going on with your body, you can sit down with your skincare and makeup.
Totally. And have a space and time just for me, only for me, where I can, like, doing my makeup in the mornings, like, I actually look forward to it.
Yeah.
I enjoy it. I really enjoy it. And it takes me out of my head, takes me away from, you know, if I am having a bad body image day or things have got to me or whatever, it gives me that 15 minutes or, you know, longer if I feel like I want to go in and do something different. It gives me that time where I can just, it's escapism. It's escapism for me as well. And a form of therapy. It feels very
Do you go into flow, that state of flow with it?
Yeah.
And so are you somebody at home, are you somebody who's like, right, I'm going out, I'm going to have a bath, I'm going to do my makeup really slowly? Like, is it a real ritual, your getting ready process?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't love baths, but my makeup, yes. And I love, like, trying out hair extensions. I've got really fine, thin hair. So I try out, like, different extensions and different hairstyles. I'm shit at all of them, but I try them, and that's the fun part, you know. I love it. Getting ready for a wedding, I love that, when you've got like an hour to do your makeup and you're like, I'm gonna try something fun, like, what am I wearing? Let me either match it to my makeup or completely clash it and just see if it works. And yeah, I love it.
So I'm gonna say to you, imagine we've got 5 minutes and I've just come up with like something cool for us to do. And I'm going to say, Alex, you've got 5 minutes. Sort yourself out. What are the ride or die bits in your makeup routine for you?
Okay. I can take or leave foundation and base outside of concealer. I always like a bit of concealer. But if I've got 5 minutes, I don't necessarily need a foundation or a skin tint. I could throw one on. I could throw a skin tint on. I love the Avène Tinted SPF. That's really
nice.
Yeah,
it's a good one.
And then I really like the Rhodial Banana Low Lighter. I've been using that. But if I want a thicker concealer, the new Vive concealer is actually beautiful.
It's literally on my face, right?
Is it same?
Yeah, it's pretty good. And the powder's good too.
More of a thicker, she's amazing. More of a thicker consistency. And then bronzer, mascara, and dry shampoo are the three things that I just actually couldn't live without. They're my three Desert Island makeup products.
Dry shampoo is so funny because only a fine-haired girl understands why you put dry shampoo on when you've just washed your hair.
Oh my God, I put dry shampoo on every single day, literally.
What's your favourite one?
Living Proof.
Yes.
Is my favourite.
It's the best.
I use the old one, the older one. Mm-hmm. The new one, I haven't used because I'm lazy and you have to wait 30 seconds, don't you? And I'm just very impatient with that. I do need to give that a go, though.
So they're slightly different. So I would say the new one is really for when your hair needs freshening up. So if you're at a festival or if you're on day two or three and you need to wash your hair, the new one is wetter and it literally cleans the hair. The old one gives you more volume and that kind of dry mattness to it. So they're different products, which is why one hasn't gone. The old one's staying because they do slightly different things.
That's why I like the because I want volume.
So you like Perfect Day, the original one?
Yes, Perfect Day. I know that's expensive. And Batiste is a great alternative as well. Love Batiste. I'm blonde, so I don't even mind like the
chalkiness.
Like, I don't mind that. That actually lifts my hair when I need to get it done. Those are my three favorite. Bronzer, cannot live without, obsessed with bronzer. I'm really into cream bronzers at the moment. I feel like I can't go back to powder bronzer just yet. I'm sure I will. I love the Iconic Sheer Bronze. That's gorgeous.
That's a lovely one, yeah.
I love. It's discontinued, but the old Nip and Fab bronzer sticks, I love those. With the, I don't know, you had a Pearl Beauty. I love their multi-purpose stick. So I apply my cream bronzer with that. Is this what you want? Like this much detail?
It is. Also, what's making me happy is that you're like giddy because you're describing products.
Yeah.
It's obviously like a thing for you, isn't it? It's like your happy place.
Yeah. And I love hearing other people's like...
Are you somebody who stares at women doing their makeup on the train? I do. Yes. I have to kind of look away every now and then so they don't think I'm weird. But I love seeing what people have got in their bag.
I love it. I love seeing what people have in their bag. And they're the things that have stayed in, like stuck in their bags, you know. Mascara, IT Cosmetics Superhero Mascara will always be my number one.
People are obsessed.
I can't say always be because you just don't know. But I feel like it will be because I am not a Glossier lash lick kind of gal.
You want big cow lashes.
I want spidery, clumpy mascara. Like the more the better. I want all out. I'm not a cool girl. I don't lean into the cool girl look. It's just not for me. I'm just not a cool girl. So I think they are my... And blush. I love a bit of cream blush as well. The Rare Beauty blush is really nice.
It's so good. There's so much pigment in it. I feel so like much. It would last 5 years because you need so little.
I know.
But it's beautiful.
I made the mistake of like throwing it on when I first got it and it was not good.
No, you've got tons of it, haven't you? You're like wiping it off, but it is absolutely terrific. Skin and Me, our brilliant sponsor here on Beyond the Bathroom, is a subscription skincare service tailored to provide exactly what your skin needs. I can vouch personally for both the service and the treatment because I myself have been a paying Skin and Me subscriber for almost 2 years and I wouldn't be without it. It's a personalised service that's tailored for your skin. Skin and Me treats conditions like acne, rosacea and hyperpigmentation, plus it works on more general skin goals like my own. Greater glow, smoother texture, softer fine lines and wrinkles and more.
Each month, you'll receive a personalised dermatologist-designed solution packed with powerful, scientifically proven active ingredients you can't buy over-the-counter, delivered in a recyclable dispenser called the Daily Doser that you twist and click each night to deliver just the right amount of cream required for a nightly application, making sure that you get the correct dose that won't damage your skin barrier. Because Skin and Me are so confident that you'll love it as much as I do, they're offering all Beyond the Bathroom listeners the opportunity to trial their first month of Skin and Me for just £3.50, instead of at the regular cost of £24.99. That includes all the check-ins you want or need, plus reformulations and advice on tap. Skin and Me want happy, healthy skin for everyone. No dermatologist wait lists required. Just use the code SALLYHUGHES, SALLYHUGHES, at checkout at skinandme.com to redeem the offer. That's SALLYHUGHES at skinandme.com.
So I've been asking all my guests, because our sponsor is Skin and Me, I've been asking all our guests, what's your Skin and Me moment? Like, when do you feel happiest and most at ease in your skin? And it doesn't have to be beauty related, but like, what? When do you just feel lovely in your own skin? What are you doing?
I actually think, and I know that we've just been talking about it, but I actually think it is doing my makeup, just because it takes me to such a joyous place. And I then see my skin and my face as this blank canvas that I can decorate, and I just find that cool and I love it.
To what degree does your body positivity extend to your home? Are you a bathroom door locker? I know you're married.
Yes.
And my friend Cher Webb did your makeup, right, for your wedding?
She did.
I was with Cher recently. She was telling me about your wedding.
Yeah. She's amazing.
Oh, she's just the best. Are you at home a bathroom door locker? Are you private about your body, or do you not get?
No, I don't. I keep the door open. Yeah, I didn't used to.
That's interesting. I think that's a bit of a key moment.
Yeah, I don't think I've consciously thought about that, but I didn't used to. I used to be, as a lot of women are, just like absolutely terrified of anyone else seeing my, even myself seeing my naked body. I would be like, you know, when you run past a mirror with like blinkers on and you try and like avoid reflection at all costs. But no, I'm much more comfortable now, definitely. I just don't, yeah, I leave the door open. I'm not parading around, but if my husband sees, he sees, and that's fine, you know.
I am a door locker, but I...
Oh, you?
I am, but I think it stems from having had small children at one time, and right, just be like, please just leave me for half an hour.
Yeah.
To have a bath. You have children scratching at the door like the undead, you know, like, get me this, get me a snack, get me that. And of course, that was many, many, many years ago. But I think it's just stuck, the idea of like lighting a candle, locking the door, putting a podcast on.
Having a bath.
Yeah, having a bath.
Do you love baths?
I am a bather, but only about once a week. The rest of the time I'm in the shower. Don't have time to have.
How long do you stay in there for?
Ages.
Do you?
Top up. Yeah.
Like over an hour?
Best part of an hour.
Really?
I would say. Tell me why you don't like baths.
I love the idea of them, mm-hmm. and especially when I'm cold and I get into them, but it has to be piping hot.
Same. Has to hurt almost when I...
Has to hurt.
Yeah.
But then I start to feel too hot and panic, and then... I just have to...
Do you get claustrophobic in?
I get claustrophobic, yeah. I asked you how long, because my husband... And when I say... I am not joking when I say he... If he does his ideal bath, it will be about 3 hours long.
Wow.
He's just this obsession with me. He loves the bath. He tops up.
Yeah, you've got to top up. Otherwise, yeah, you get cold.
Just like, it's just his happy place. And he'll just sit and sit and just work from there. He just lives in there. It's quite something. It's quite impressive.
Wow. He's got a nice big bath. He can language.
We don't actually. We're moving to a new place, and we do need it because he's tall as well. We need a proper bath because his feet are up on the wall like legs akimbo. So we do need to sort that out. Yeah.
This journey started as such a personal one for you. It was to do with your health, your body image, your past, and that propelled you into the work that you do. Do you feel defined by body issues? Do you feel that people don't want you to talk about anything else, or do you feel like you want to talk about something else? It's a lot to always be around the thing that was actually at one time a really severe trigger for you.
I mean, the triggering is less of an issue mm-hmm. nowadays, for mm-hmm. sure. I feel like I can talk about what I've been through with distance. Like I feel distance from it, and I feel like I've really healed from it. So it doesn't trigger me to talk about my journey, for lack of a better word. I guess sometimes I feel like I want to wake up and not talk about body issues.
Yeah.
But I'm soon reminded that there was a reason that I felt galvanized to do this work in the first place. And that there are a lot of women who it feels like are counting on me in a way. Not to like blow my own, you know, not to... But there were a lot of women who were in the place that I was in, and I feel like I have the power to be able to help them in a small way. Not the power to heal them. I'm not, you know, I have a platform and I can shout about things that ultimately might lead to change and might help women feel a little bit better about their bodies. And that feels really important. And it feels like I can't step away from that. And I do have days where I think I just can't talk about this stuff today. Like maybe I'm having a bad day myself and I will step away from it. And that's the power of also being on social media, is that you can to an extent choose when and what you talk about, right? But in the end, I'm always drawn back to it because I feel like this is, I have a sense, this has given me a sense of purpose. And my purpose does lie in this space.
And to what degree has that kindness and that purpose helped you? What do you think when you look in the mirror? How do you feel about Alex?
I used to pore over my reflection in the mirror for ages, always in a really critical way. I almost wanted to find things to punish myself about because I was so self-loathing and I just despised myself so much. And that's sad to say, but I just hated myself. And I would just look at my reflection for hours and you know, sit there and like cry and like pinch at things and
grabbing flesh and imagining what it would be like if it wasn't there.
Totally.
Such a thing, isn't it, for women?
Such a common thing. Now it just doesn't, I really don't spend that much time in front of the mirror. I mean, when I'm doing my makeup, then I spend loads of time in front of the mirror, but it's not necessarily looking at me. It's looking at like what I'm doing to me. But it just, I feel like I'm at a place where what I see in the mirror doesn't impact how I feel and how I live my life for the most part. You know, I'm never going to say that I'm like fully healed and like, yay, like live this like blissful existence where body image doesn't come into, you know, doesn't negatively impact me, because it does. But for the most part, what I see in the mirror doesn't impact how I live my life, which is, I think, a really good goal for everyone and all women. You don't have to look at the mirror and think, God, you look gorgeous. Like, this is amazing. I love every part of myself. If you can have a neutrality about how you look, which is, I feel like where I'm at, things ebb and change. Like, I know that everything's fluid, but I feel like that's where I'm at. And that feels wonderful after a lifetime of being so preoccupied and so bogged down and weighed down by how I look.
It sounds like you've reached that place, which is the best place I think we can realistically get to, where everything becomes a scar rather than an open wound.
Right.
And you're doing all right, I think.
Yeah.
If you're a bit scarred, because we're all a bit scarred.
I like that analogy. That's nice, yeah.
Alex Light, you've been brilliant. Thank you so much. That's it for this episode. Thank you so much to Alex Light for putting her best face forward.
Please subscribe and follow to Beyond the Bathroom wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you left a rating and a review. I'll see you next time with my next guest. Bye.
Insanity Group.